This month's podcast features David P. Driscoll, who served as the 22nd Commissioner of Education in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts from 1998 until 2007. In his 49-year career in public education, Dr. Driscoll was a math teacher, an assistant superintendent, a superintendent, deputy commissioner, interim commissioner, and the state commissioner who inaugurated standards-based education in Massachusetts under the education reform law. Currently, he serves on a number of boards, including as chair of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute Board and the National Assessment Governing Board. In this podcast, you'll hear Dr. Driscoll assess how the education reform law is working today.
I don't think there's any way to characterize it other than a success story.
Explain how MCAS is a standards-based assessment.
I think what's important is it's not just a walk into the room and take an IQ test or an SAT test or even an advanced placement, which is somewhat standards-based. In the MCAS, we're very clear on what the standards are and what we're going to test.
And how individual support for students is essential to their success.
But they also have their individual needs. And I think as a system, we ought to be trying to balance those two things. We should have a regular program and then have ways that kids can get individual help, support, whatever.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized, self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by recovering learning loss, reaching and maintaining grade-level skills, and achieving equity. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. A former secondary school mathematics teacher, David P. Driscoll was appointed Massachusetts Deputy Commissioner of Education just days after the state's Education Reform Act was signed into law in 1993. He became Interim Commissioner of Education on July 1, 1998, and was named Commissioner on March 10, 1999. In a recent conversation with JFY's Executive Director Gary Kaplan, he reflected on the state's success in meeting the goals set by the Education Reform Act and the impact the Massachusetts law, which predated No Child Left Behind by a decade, has had on students.
Former Commissioner Dave Driscoll, it's a pleasure to have you on board here for the highly respected, highly regarded JFY Networks podcast. After this, of course, will be even more highly respected and highly regarded. Dave, we were just sort of commenting on the fact that this article appeared in the Globe about rethinking the Education Reform Act. And of course, you were right there when all that was happening. Could you kind of give an over, like your own overview of, has the Education Reform Act of 1993, which you were right in the middle of, has it fulfilled its promise? Has it done what it was intended to do for public education in Massachusetts?
I don't think there's any way to characterize it other than a success story, for sure. I mean, we leaped to the front of the country. We were the first state to ever have the highest scale score in fourth grade reading, fourth grade math, eighth grade reading, and eighth grade math. We weren't even in the top 20. I verified that in the early 90s. There were times when we dipped out of the top 10 and even more. So clearly it was a success story. I think one thing that's missing from that article, and you know this well because you were in the middle of it, sort of the rethinking is interesting because the thought that went into it from Jack Rennie, really, who was the main cornerstone person in the thinking, was that we're going to have a two-sided approach here. We're going to give schools and districts the tools they need, but then we're going to hold them accountable. So you might remember we were booming along and at the height of number one in the country and all of that. when the recession hit.
In 08, 09.
Yeah, before the recession, just before the recession, when money was still flowing, the legislature appropriated $25 million for tutoring for MCAT. I didn't even ask for it. It wasn't even a request. They just came up with the idea because at that point, we had won the battle. And clearly, MCAS was going to stay in place, and it proved itself. And the only question was, how do we get the numbers up from the high 80% to 90% and so forth? And then the numbers continued to improve, so they gave me $40 million the next year. Well, we got the high school up to well into the 90s. And it was then that we decided to look at middle schools. And that's when the recession hit. They took the money away. And it wasn't long, probably 2 or 3 years, when all of the new monies under ed reform were being drowned out by cost of special education, et cetera. So they were actually back laying off teachers, cutting back programs, and so forth. So that's a little known factor.
And this is the effect of the recession.
Exactly. And we were closing gaps pretty remarkably. I remember, you might remember, the tutoring, we allowed districts to use their own discretion to come up with different programs. Worcester came up with a program where they took kids who were failing MCAS, they put them on campuses where they got tutoring and they could do work study because these poor kids needed, these were poor kids. And an amazing thing happened. So half of them went, did MCAS tutoring in the morning and a work study job in the afternoon, and the others vice versa. Well, a strange thing happened. Those kids saw a campus for the first time. They were at WPI or wherever, all across Worcester. And they decided they liked going to college and they could do it. And many of them enrolled in community college and so forth. So there was a time when we were sort of at our peak and we were marching towards going over. There were only a couple of states. Texas was one. You could sort of name Florida since, and maybe Tennessee, but no one has really closed significantly the achievement gaps because of all the issues. It's not just schools. It's all the issues kids have to go through in their lives and so forth. And you were part of that because JFY was used pretty extensively by a lot of the districts. And we were getting kids not only up passing MCAS, but they were then wanting to go even further and qualify for community colleges and so forth. So that was really the heyday, sort of the late 90s, just before the recession hit. Mm-hmm. And that's a little known factor. And then everything went back, the poor got poorer and so forth. And so MCAS was not an issue because it was an eighth grade standard at the 10th grade level. The teachers knew what was expected. The kids know what's expected. So passing MCAS became a non-issue, so to speak. Plus, we had all these programs that we put in place, tutoring programs, appeal process, if you was phobic, et cetera, test phobic. So that, to me, was a big part of it. I'll tell you one thing, Gary, that was a very good lesson for me as commissioner. Many of the schools came to me, a few of the superintendents, and said, look, we want to take teachers and have them tutor kids during their free period and pay them. They'll give up their free period and they'll tutor kids. And I said, geez, I can't be part of double dipping here. I mean, you know, it just doesn't seem right. And so they sort of sat me down and said, look, first of all, you have to understand these kids have to work as soon as school ends. They get responsibilities at home. They go right to work. So there's no way we're getting them after school. Secondly, the teachers are doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They're giving up their free period. We're not paying them, you know, their salary. We're giving them a tutor's salary. So they're really doing it out of the goodness of their heart. And they're the perfect people because they're the best teachers and they know the kids. And so I said, well, okay, I'll let you try it. Well, it turned out to be a huge success. So that was an example of where a lot of people say, I never listened. I listened. That's one place that one time I listened, Gary.
Well, Dave, I don't know that a lot of people said you didn't listen. I certainly didn't. I mean, sometimes you didn't feel like listening, but you actually did anyway. Did you really feel like people said you didn't listen?
I mean, everybody goes through this. I had to make decisions and I had to stick with them. And so it's easy then to say,
he's not listening.
Yeah, there was a group of superintendents that were, you know, calling me out, so to speak. But the majority stayed with me, and we had a private session during the summer at MASS summer session. We had it out. And I think the give and take, I mean, everybody's busy. Everybody was under pressure. And I think people started to realize that I was doing things because the law told me to. And it was my responsibility. So we had a happy ending, but there were bumps along the way, naturally. You know, an interesting experience I had one time with a group of two interesting experiences. The first was with a group of suburban parents who came to a meeting with signs that said down with MCAS and so forth and so on. And they railed against the law. And when I got to speak, I said, look, I understand the emotion denying diplomas, but the fact is, as you well knew, Gary, at the time, and it's why Jack Rennie got so much gravitas with the legislature and the governor's office. We had thousands of kids graduating from high school who the community colleges and business were telling us didn't even have basic skills, even the basic skills, and yet they had diplomas. And so with this group of suburban parents, I finally made the case. Rationality kind of persuaded them that, well, let's wait and see. And of course, they were worried about their own dyslexic kids or something.
Yeah.
They left their signs, by the way, in the auditorium when they left. The principal had to pick them all up the next day. But I said to them at the end, look, this is before we gave MCAS when it counted. I said, your kids are going to be fine. Trust me. It's an eighth grade standard at the 10th grade level. I said, but I like your activity here, your proactiveness. Come back and help me with the inner city. And you should commit yourself to that. Well, of course, they never did. The other thing was, no matter where I went, I got clobbered. And parents are just, it was tough. It was very emotional. So right before, it was interesting, one of the last meetings I had before MCAS counted was with a group of Boston parents. Somebody had arranged for me to go to this group of, they weren't formalized. They weren't the citywide PTO or whatever. They were a group of parents who would come together through activity or whatever. They were almost all women, and they were a great majority African-American. So I met with them, and I was prepared to go through another night of taking blows. And they were completely different. They said to me, listen, you keep it up. MCAS is the best thing that's happened. I said, what? They said, they're paying attention to our kids. They never paid attention to our kids. Now they worry about what the kids are learning. It's the first time, so keep it up. So that was a real, probably my only positive experience during that time, but it was remarkable. And they were right, and they saw it best. So thank goodness for that group, whoever arranged it.
So that was early 2000s, before 2003, when it actually started to count.
Before 2001, when it, right.
Yeah. Well, that question right there, nobody had paid attention to the kids before, and now all of a sudden they were. But there's still, of course, pretty much the same gap between performance in Wellesley and performance in the inner city. That hasn't narrowed much at all. What do you think could be done to make some progress on that front, narrowing the gap between both? Well, it's just kind of two aspects, high income, lower income, and white and Asian and Black and Hispanic. Yeah. Still, the gaps are still there.
Well, again, I think the one of the tremendous strengths of MCAS, I think you've talked about it, is, and I think it's even in that article kind of hidden, is the issue that MCAS gives you the data. I mean, that's the beauty of it. Well, there isn't any surprise. The gaps were there. As I say, I'll make the one footnote, we were making game. And you're never going to close. You're talking about kids who live in conditions that are completely different. And so the school isn't going to be able to make up the tremendous gap, although we should be doing a lot better. So I think we need to learn some lessons. And the pandemic certainly helped us to recognize it. It also verified and put a spotlight on mental health issues, which are tremendous today across the country. And the issue like food deprivation and things like that, it's just unbelievable in 2023 in America. It's just crazy. And so as long as it's only schools that are trying to close gaps, and maybe some social service agencies, and maybe some prison guards, you know, where we've been an uphill fight. So I think that what we have to recognize is that the biggest, we have to have the tools. So the tools start out with the basics, which is standards and clear goals around reading, math, et cetera, the academic goals. Those should be a given.
Dave, let me just interject here. The other day when we were talking, you made a distinction between standardized testing and standards-based testing.
Right.
Now, nobody ever uses the term standards-based. They use the term standardized.
Right.
Why is that important?
Well, it's important. And of course, you know, I guess you could say that technically, you know, it's quite norm reference, criterion reference. You could classify MCAS technically as a standardized test, but I think it's very important to make the distinction, because standardized tests, the sort of SAT type situation, is norm reference, where, you know, certain, there's a mean and then so many kids above it and so forth. And so you're kind of scattered and spread out according to a preconceived set of numbers. Whereas with MCAS, 100% could get 100. It's standards based. And
that's
so
right.
I think, without getting into the psychometrics of it all, I think what's important is it's not just a walk into the room and take an IQ test or an SAT test or even an advanced placement, which is somewhat standards based. In the MCAS, we're very clear on what the standards are and what we're going to test. And then we tell you afterwards what standard it relied on. So I do think that's a very important issue. So I think those two, I think the basic psychometric tools are there. Unfortunately, and you could write a book on this, teachers are still not applying, not consistently across the board, sound pedagogical ways of getting the kids to the standards, part of which is to get kids engaged and get kids motivated, et cetera, et cetera. So just having the standards in and of themselves doesn't quite do it, but we have those. And so that's the beginning. And so the question then is, how do you get kids? I remember a teacher in Boston, an African-American woman that had been around for many years, and Deval Patrick and I visited her classroom. She wasn't phased at all. Senior high school teacher, and she said to us, look, you two, set standards high as you want to stand them. I mean, do it right, get them where they ought to be, but then get out of the way and let me get my kids, who I know, as far along as I can get them. And in some cases, I'll move them, you know, fairly well along. Others, it's going to be baby steps, because what they're dealing with at home or what they're dealing with emotionally and et cetera is daunting.
Yeah.
So I think that is the issue, is we've got to get the kids as far along as we can. You're never going to necessarily close a gap when kids have the advantages of summer school or tutors or have been going to Tanglewood every year. Summer, you know,
parents with college degrees,
social aspects. But you've proven, and this is where what's amazing to me, and a big flaw of public education, a big flaw in our rethinking, if you will, We don't capitalize always on what works. And there are great success stories. You're one of them. You turned around. I have to tell this story. I can't be on this podcast without telling the story. First time I ever met Gary, he came into my office and he told me he had a way of helping kids meet the standards of MCAS in both math and reading. And I said to him, look, don't talk to me. Go to some Madison Park High School where they've got the biggest problems in the whole state. Turn that place around and then come back and talk to me. Well, he did. He went to Madison Park. Principal at the time wasn't a vocational guy at all. He'd come out of Charlestown. And Chuck took Gary's program in at my request. And he turned it around. And just recently with East Boston High School and then again at Madison Park, you've made up the difference with the pandemic. So, you know, we just don't take advantage. I told the story. They dedicated the High School Learning Commons after me recently, which was a thrill.
In Melrose.
I'm the youngest of 10 children. It was quite a thrill to have that named after me. 43 nieces and nephews, many that went through the high school. But I told the story about my wife, who was a reading teacher at a vocational school, North Shore Vocational School. She became the Title I, well, director. They only had the one person. So she was the Title I teacher director and was able to access funds. So she set up a lab. She had the best of hardware and the best of software to take kids similar to you, but it was just in reading.
Yeah.
And she would take kids, some of whom were reading at the fifth grade level. She would put them on individualized programs, use Read 180 as one example. She played classical music in the background. One day, this big football kid came up and said to her, "Hey, Mrs. D, you forgot the music." And then she would, set them up. And if they finished their assignment, she had magazines there and other things they could do and so forth. And it just worked like a charm. She had tremendous results. And she retired. The same year I did, and the program went away.
Because there was nobody there who was committed to it.
So here you are at East Boston High School. And if there were a West Boston High School, but there's plenty of other high schools, why aren't they chomping at the door to get you there? And so this is the issue of public education. We're asked to fix these problems, very deep societal problems. And very often we do are given certain tools, but not all the tools. So think about the health services that many of these kids need that they're really not getting, et cetera. So, but our job is to go get as that woman said, get as far as we can. Yeah. And fortunately in Massachusetts, we've done it better than anyone else, but it's still not good enough. And it certainly isn't good enough for those kids that suffer the most.
You know, speaking of your wife, do you have any opinion on the ongoing battle between phonics and whole language in reading instruction?
There is the science of reading. And people who think one way or the other extreme, that, oh, it's all about whole language, we don't need phonics, or all we need is phonics, they're wrong. I mean, kids are different and they read differently and they respond differently, brain-wise and so forth. So what they call the science of reading, what people have put out, is this combination. And whatever it takes to get a kid to start to be able to understand and read. So I've always liked the balance approach. You might remember, this was an interesting story. I myself, as an individual, looked at the results of fourth grade mathematics, being an old math teacher, and couldn't understand why 60% of the kids got a basic division problem wrong.
What year is this?
99. I went around to talk to some of my math coordinators, people I knew and so forth. They said to me, well, we don't do algorithms anymore, which is the borrowing, as we know it. So that's a problem. So I put it, we were just redoing the math standards. So I put in the standards that algorithms is one way that kids should be taught the basic math processes. We didn't test it. We didn't mandate it. It was just put there. But everybody got the idea. So they started to have kids do that as well. All of a sudden, the next test, 60% of the kids could do. And then it got better. And really, it wasn't a case of that. I went into a classroom. The woman was from Lesley University, which she wanted to tell me. She was doing Q's and A rods on the floor and all that kind of thing, which didn't bother me. I'm all for that. Kids seem to enjoy it. They seem to be learning. That doesn't bother me. I'm a balanced approach guy. She said to me, I know you're an algorithms guy. She said, but see this kid over here? He can add a column of numbers. I know you're a math or a former math teacher. He could add a column of two numbers faster than you can using my method, which is if it's 18, the kid says it's 20 and keeps the minus two in his head, etc. And evidently he's good at it. I said to her, well, good for you. I said, however, I have a feeling that I could best him if it were three column of three numbers. And I would bet my shirt on the fact I could beat him if it was a column of four numbers. Because he's not keeping the 326 in his head and the 184 and the 299 and whatever. So she kind of smiled. I said, it's common sense. That's my book, Commitment and Common Sense. Oh, right. I have the same feeling towards the reading. To me, it's how do they get kids engaged and motivated to read? That's what I look at in classrooms. And thank God we don't have 100%, but we have a great majority of our teachers that do a great job.
Engaged and motivated, those are kind of key words. So how do you do that? I mean, some teachers, you were probably one of them, just seem to have a natural sense of how to do that with kids. But how do you, not everybody does. How do you teach that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know. If I were that smart, I'd be teaching at, you know, I'd have been involved in the teacher development program. There again, the system lets us down. The teacher evaluation system, as you know, in most schools is perfunctory at best. The principals can't get around. When they get around, they're doing a lot better. There's a lot better science around that too.
Yeah.
You drop in constantly and understand and see the rhythm and that kind of thing. I don't know. I think, you know, good teachers and great teachers know their kids and they know how to get the kids. And they know the ones that are falling behind and they, you know, you find different ways. And I think your model is the model that should serve in the country. I think we've seen this with the pandemic. We need, in addition to regular schooling and the school experience, we need then an individual approach, almost like the medical profession. You need to take their temperature and see what they're, you know, see what's functioning and what isn't. And so your idea of sort of supplementary tutoring, if you will, targeted, is a model that's worked, and it works across the country, the mentoring programs and so forth. So kids become part of a group going through the fifth grade, sixth grade, whatever, and you can argue about the grade spans and all that, but they go through that, but they also have their individual needs. And I think as a system, we ought to be trying to balance those two things. We should have a regular program and then have ways that kids can get individual help, support, whatever. And the pandemic was a disaster in terms of online, but it doesn't have to be. So a kid could, I remember tutoring a kid. We decided as a administrative team in Malden that we would tutor kids in MCAS at Malden High School that had failed to show the assessment people and so forth. And I had this young lady who was bright enough, but she had been missing all along the line. She couldn't do basic math. She couldn't do basic. If she do a pro problem, she did a formula, you know, and got it down to x equals 6x equals 24. And I said, therefore, x equals, she couldn't do it. I said, what? So I sent her to the library. I said, don't tell anybody. With a basic disk in those days that had basic math. I said, look, you take that. You know, don't tell anybody what you're doing. Tell me, Commissioner Driscoll gave you this special thing you're doing, this project you're doing, special. She was down doing 2 times 2, 6 times 8, whatever. And she passed MCAS. You know, I think your model really is something that, and I'm not just saying it because you know this. I'm not just saying this because we're on this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, you've been, I was 100% supporter of yours, not only for budget, but for expansion. As you know, I've talked to people, even did some work with you after I retired. Yeah. You know, your program works.
It does.
Things that work. Like Read 180, you know, which is for people that don't know, is a program whereby the reading level fits the student.
Yeah.
Four of us are reading Ivanhoe. Unfortunately, I'm not quite at your level. So my version of Ivanhoe is something I can read and comprehend, but I can partake of discussions and so forth and so on. And it's a program that, once you get the basics, then you become a better reader, etc., and you catch up. Then you're catching people up all the time. You've proven it at Madison Park. You've proven it.
So it kind of gets back to there are methods, methodologies that actually work and have enough documentation behind them that it can be considered a reliable thing. Read 180 or the product that we use, Achieve 3000 or Math Space or whatever. And if it's put together properly and if it's used properly, it does produce results. But we have never been able to get enough people to actually do it, even though, you know, we can say, look here, look at the CEES Boston thing here. We just wrote a whole book about it. They got all the way back to 2019 levels, basically just by doing what we said, which is, by the way, why it works at East Boston, because when we lay out a program, they actually execute it. They actually do it. In most places, they do some of it. They do half of it. They don't really do it systematically. And we've never been able to get, you know, 100 schools to adopt the program, even though it could easily do 100 schools. It could do more than 100 schools. Why is that? Why is it that in this, you know, in this this advanced public education system in this state, which probably is the best in the country, why can't we get people to say, okay, it works. I read the report. It works. Driscoll says it works. So, of course, we're going to do it.
Well, I mean, I think this is the problem. So I see two colliding worlds. First is the outside world, that world outside of public schools. That intrudes itself in many ways into the system. Most recently, you have parents who have become, with social media and so forth, now accusing teachers of banning books. I mean, come on, we're banning books. I mean, give me a break. So there are always forces in society, it seems, that work against us. So there are people who say, well, you know, we shouldn't pay teachers, and on it goes. So we have this outside world that makes sure that we never get it completely right. Then we have our own shortfalls, one of which is that we don't understand and celebrate successes and build on them systematically. We just don't. You know, people leave, and very often, programs go with them. Think about the Burke, Jeremiah Burke.
Yeah.
Think about the Jeremiah Burke High School, which at one point went to the second best level in Massachusetts from level five to level two. Yeah. That principal is now she's now an assistant superintendent in Boston. And I saw the whole whole video on her. I still keep it.
Lydia.
I saw her one day and I said, you're not going to believe I keep very few videos, but I'm going to show you one. And she couldn't believe I kept hers. And hers was just common sense.
Yeah.
She walked in, they were suspending hundreds of kids every day for poor hair or being late or all this. And she made a deal. She said, I'm not going to suspend you, but let's take it seriously and work. And she wound up suspending 100 kids the whole year, et cetera. And then they focused on the, they got a grant, federal grant. So, but why isn't that program, which now was turned into a video as and the principles as to why it worked, principles, why it worked, are available to every school in Boston.
But nobody does it.
The elements of that, at least, across the board. And we have such a parochial approach to schools and districts and sometimes states.
Yeah.
States are very parochial.
Absolutely.
Ironically, which, you know, I think we changed at one time. We also, I think, a hidden advantage of No Child Left Behind with President George W. Bush was the bipartisanship. You know, Massachusetts and Texas worked together. The commissioners across the country, blue and red states, we all worked together. You know, and that's now becoming fractured again. So we shoot ourselves in the foot very often, Gary, and it's a shame. Well, for some reason, our public education as a entity process is not, certainly not seen as a science. It sort of catches catch can, you know, what did I come up with today? And it's an unfortunate thing. And all this money that's spent, the Gates Foundation, et cetera, they tried the small schools. I mean, it just, it's very difficult to change people, all of society basically is what you have to do, let alone the society and the schools. And starting in the schools, it's not uniform, let alone when you start to involve people outside the schools.
It's kind of, there's no, like in science, for example, where you've got people all over the world working on something like right now, working on artificial intelligence. There is interconnection and there's continuity. Somebody develops something in Palo Alto, 25 other people in the Netherlands or China or Brazil are going to grab onto that and do the next round of innovation. And then 5,000 other people are going to grab onto that and replicate it. So you've got a sort of collegiality and you've got continuity and people pay attention to what happened and what works. And then they grab it and they try to improve upon it. That does not seem to happen in education.
I think it's gotten even worse. I mean, if you think about, to me, the whole controversy over vaccinations with the pandemic, it's just unbelievable. I mean, I had former students now, they're in their 50s and 60s, on Facebook and other places saying, you know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to get vaccinated. I mean, so I felt like saying, so you know more than all the doctors and all the nurses. I remember when we were young, you might remember, Gary, we had the polio vaccine.
Absolutely.
Well, they didn't have my permission, or I wasn't, I was told to get the hell down there.
You just did it, yeah.
So I worry that even science, we can't even agree on science. But, you know, you think about, let me give you, to me, the worst, the shocker to me was when the Common Core state standards were established. I mean, if you read them, nobody ever reads them. But if you read them, they're just words on a page. And then the next thing you know, people said, well, I had this textbook and they're using these examples and they got gay kids to take doing math. And well, it had nothing to do with the Common Core. And it became a political liability. All these states, I knew them.
Sure,
they were adopting the Common Core, but they couldn't call it that, so they were calling it something else. I mean, so it's how silly things can get. So that's the problem that we have. And I think what I was able to do, and I think other successful educational leaders are able to do, is have a semblance of order that says, wait a minute, you know, we're going to go at this logically. Each step is going to be logical. We're going to try and find a logical way forward, whether it's as I had to close schools and reorganize grades when I was a superintendent, certainly all the issues I dealt with in implementing the Education Reform Act, sometimes you push, sometimes you pull, et cetera. And I think we need to try and get back to that because we're not making progress. It's almost like two steps forward and three steps back. You know, I don't know whether we're going to get back to essentials or not, but we had that great opportunity. It takes leadership. It started, I mean, a lot of people think it started with a nation at risk, which I think was a certainly a game changer. But I think more importantly was the coming together of George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, other governors at the time, both Republican and Democratic, that forged this alliance to set standards and so forth. So I think we need leadership again. I'm a big fan of Mary Skipper. I think she's terrific. I certainly like from a distance what I see with Mayor Wu. We've had great leadership with Governor Charlie Baker, and I think Governor Healey seems to be off to a very good start. So we, and the Secretary of Education seems to be fine. I only knew him slightly in Lynn, but you know, he comes with a great reputation. Mm. So once again, I think here in Massachusetts, we've got the makings, good legislative leadership around education, as you know. You know, we, if any state can do it, we can do it. And I think that's what it takes is leadership and a combination of common sense, following the science and making progress and being honest about where we are. And we're at a bad place right now. The gaps are intolerable and we need to, so that's why there has to be a rethinking. Ed reform as it progressed was a great success story, but not around closing the gaps. And so there is a rethinking. And I'll end this way. I think you're onto something because you've proven it even during the pandemic. So I think that's a model, this kind of individualized in addition to what kind of services can we bring to kids in addition to their regular services in schools, because schools can't do it alone. So we need to bring health services. We need to bring certain tutoring to catch gaps, which they can't catch in a group setting. Teachers are too busy. So schedules are such. Some can do it. One would hope that if you were a seventh grade teacher and you had a kid that wasn't able to do basic mathematics, you'd figure out a way to get that kid up to where he or she needs to be before you'd continue on. But unfortunately, you know, that seventh grade teacher may have five classes of 26 kids, et cetera. And then a teacher goes on maternity leave, et cetera. So I think the system needs to have a way of shoring up. And that, to me, is this way of having auxiliary services. And they don't have to be provided necessarily by educators. They may have to be, may very well be, health service people or others. You know, a grandmother that speaks the language in certain parts of the state may be a better tutor for kids, even if she hasn't had the formal training. You can give her what she needs than anybody else. So I think that's what, if we're really serious about it, that's what we have to focus on. And I'll leave you with this one last, when they talk about AI, the one thing about technology, it's always been true, is it's infinitely patient. And so, you know, why we don't take more advantage of technology for kids is beyond me. Now, I don't want kids just sitting at a screen all day long. We certainly have that problem. They're at screens all night long. Right. But with respect to certain ways of making sure they're at certain baseline knowledge, et cetera, et cetera, technology would be the perfect way to do it. It even could be engaging I remember going to the Harvard Kent. I went to the Harvard Kent School as commissioner. It was a first grade, and the kids were 90% Asian, and they were all doing a program in mathematics. They were doing addition, and the little guy would jump up and go, yippee, if he got it right.
Yeah.
So we stood at the back of the class, and all you could see was yippee, 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 yippee. And I even, as the wise guy in me, I even tried to distract a couple of the kids. I remember a little girl with pigtails. I tried to distract her. She was focused on that screen. Yippee, yippee, yippee. So after the class was over, I went up to the teacher and said, gee, that's great. Kids seem to do well. She said, well, you know, it's interesting. She said, I am the bilingual teacher for these kids. And I said, well, isn't that nice? She said, yeah, except I don't speak their dialect. So I might as well be speaking Swahili. So I engaged them in English, and I engaged them on the computer. And they learn their math facts, and they learn English. But they're not going to, we can't talk to each other otherwise.
So that is really interesting.
Really interesting experience. So,
well, thank you, Dave. This is a great start. It's we will pick this up again in a couple of weeks.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Good luck. Good luck on the golf course.
Thank you.
We would like to thank Dr. David P. Driscoll for joining us this month for the JFY Networks podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free educational resources, including these monthly podcasts, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.